You know, it was Captain Kirk. He once said, space, the final frontier. In a moment, a very special 3 hours with Sir Charles Schulz III on Coast to Coast AM. Sir Charles Schulz worked at Martin Marietta Aerospace for 10 years on weapon systems and computer-based automated test equipment. He wrote the nuclear EMP test software for the Pershing II missile system, worked on the Patriot and Copperhead tank killer and advanced attack helicopter systems. And Sir Charles has performed research under Grant on nuclear fusion, was knighted, and received a long-term grant for his present research in robotics and artificial intelligence. He has written many technical publications and magazine articles on space, astronomy, the atmosphere, and space resource development, and is rapidly becoming a regular here on Coast to Coast. My pleasure. First time I've talked with Sir Charles Schulz. Hello, Sir Charles. How are you?
Great, George, and thanks. It will be our first show together.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to this. It's always fun and exciting to break new ground. And I've had a chance to listen to a couple of your chats with Art, and you bring some very fascinating topics to the table, Sir Charles.
Well, thank you. Let's see if we can expand everyone's mind and horizons just a little bit tonight.
Absolutely. Tell me a little bit more about yourself, just for my own benefit, how you got into this field of science and now you're doing what you're doing.
Well, I've always been fascinated by science. I mean, I've always had a drive to know how things work and where things came from. And so it was just a very natural thing for me to look at space and science and technology, and I eventually ended up working in the field because it was something that I enjoyed a great deal, and I felt I was able to make some contributions to.
Did it start as a boyhood wonder, like it did with so many of us?
Well, yeah, you know, I've always had chemistry and electronics components around, studied rocks, great interest in anything mathematical and scientific, and so it just sort of bloomed early on in my career. I ended up in aerospace, and it's just taken off from there.
You got to be happy with the fact that NASA says they plan to go back May of 2008 to fix the Hubble.
Well, that is an interesting thought. I'm not necessarily in agreement that it's the best course to pursue. There are some risks involved, but, you know, now that they've decided to do it, let's hope they do it properly.
Do you think it was worth the it's going to be worth the $900 million? And I'm sure that number will go higher by the time we get up there.
Well, I know that there are a number of better space telescopes available and that we have a lot of them on the drawing board that could be completed pretty rapidly and get into, you know, deployment and in operation. I don't know if $900 million is really, you know, it's worth the price tag, but there's a great deal of historical interest, and Hubble has a long-running service life, and a lot of people depend on it. So perhaps they'll get what they're after.
Do you see space travel moving toward privatization?
Oh, absolutely. It's just like any other form of transportation. The only thing that has been holding us up in the past primarily is destinations. There's nothing really close to the Earth that you can get to easily and cheaply. And, of course, government competition has greatly squelched a lot of private development up until just recently when it's been demonstrated that private industry can do it just as effectively and far more cheaply than governments can at this time.
Will there be restrictions, regulations on those privateers? Here's an example. What if a company decides, hey, you know what, we're going to get into weaponry in space. We're going to do some of those kinds of things. Do you think governments will put a kibosh on those companies?
Well, yes. Right now, governments only like themselves to be in charge of the weapons, and of course, we really don't want to see
yes.
a proliferation of weapons in space. So far, space has remained a very clean environment, and conflicts, as we know them on the ground, really haven't occurred there. And I don't really want to see an expansion of that sort. So you can believe that there's going to be a great deal of effort to suppress the development of private weapon systems in space, certainly.
How do you see the future of space and space travel, Sir Charles, let's say over the next 20 years?
Well, I do expect within the next 20 years we're going to see a huge growth in the private sector, because most of the government efforts have been rather narrow or aimed at specific tasks, and the private sector has a lot of other things in mind. We can use space for a lot of reasons that are generally not available to the government, and what I really see is the growth in the private industry will far outstrip anything in the government sector.
By the way, I want to invite everybody to get up to the coasttocoastam.com website. Take a look at the graphics and the pictures, the images that Sir Charles has sent us. And there's a link to his website, xenotechresearch.com. We'll be talking about Mars in a moment during our program. The fascination that you have brought to the table here with space and looking at these images, and we'll dive a little deeper in them, but do you find them yourself now, Sir Charles, or do people bring them to your attention?
Well, most of the research I do myself, and I have to admit that some of the best images in the last 3 or 4 months have been brought forward by a number of people who visit my site and have become regular correspondents with me. So, you know, there's an equal helping at this point of what I find and what others find. And, of course, you'll notice that every time somebody else makes a finding, I'm certain to give them credit on the site because there's more than enough for everyone to go around.
Absolutely. You know, I've contemplating what it would be like to do a broadcast in space. I don't know if we'd put up the funds to go up there and do a one-time program like that, but a lot of people are starting to plunk down a couple $100,000 for the rights to go up into space at the same time. And, of course, we know people are paying millions to the Russians to go up into space. Do you see those costs coming down dramatically for the average person?
Oh, yes, I do. As the expansion in the private sector occurs, the cost will definitely come down. Right now, the only reason it's so expensive is because most of the systems that are in flight today have been developed by military and government organizations, and there was a large price tag associated with them at the time. Fortunately, there's a great deal of Russian hardware that's really gone into more or less mass production, almost like an automobile line, and it brings the cost down significantly. From what I understand, the cost of a single passenger on one of the Soyuz flights pretty much pays for all of its operation.
Well, that's smart business on their part, isn't it?
Well, yes, it is, and you can expect to see much more of that in the coming times. Right now, there are many different packages that are offered to private citizens for space travel and tourism, and of course, we know of the 4 space tourists that have already flown, and there's a lot of interesting information out there about people who are interested in space tourism and flying their own hardware in space. And so we're going to cover a lot of that tonight. I've got a great deal of information about that. I think people will find really fascinating to find out what's available.
Great. At what time are they going to take us around the moon? Is that going to happen?
Oh, well, no. That's a very good question. And already there is a package offered. Now, you have to be rather rich to do it. But for the cost of roughly $100 million, there is a trip to lunar orbit and back that's being offered by the same company that's done all the space tourism up to this point. SpaceAdventures.com is their website. And they've already flown 4 tourists to the International Space Station, all above aboard Russian rockets as the launching vehicle. And they are also announcing that they have possibilities of a spacewalk. So typically a space tourist will pay about $20 million for a flight to the ISS. And if for $35 million, they can have a 90-minute spacewalk thrown in as part of the deal.
I wonder if they would hold my check until after I returned. I would post-date it.
I don't know. I think they get pretty curious about whether it's good or not up front.
Isn't that amazing, though, that some people, and I'm sure they've got the wherewithal, would plunk down that kind of money to go up into space?
Well, if you've made that sort of money that you can spare that, and you've done just about everything already, and, you know, a lot of people who are extremely wealthy have pretty much done all the thrilling things in their lives that are available to them, then this is just one more notch in the belt, you know, a really thrilling experience, something unique that you can do. And I think in part it's just a demonstration of the fact that you are capable of doing it. You know, there's always the effect that people have of showing off what they're capable of. But, you know, there's a great thrill of adventure there. And the positive aspect of it is when they fund a flight like this, they're actually helping the development of commercial space flight for everyone.
No, there's no doubt about that. They are pioneers, I think, in getting all of us one day to be able to do that. Do you envision, you know, I fly back and forth between Los Angeles and St. Louis quite often. Do you envision the day that we will be in a plane or some kind of vehicle, we'll go up 70, 80,000 feet in the air from, let's say, L.A. and plunk right down in St. Louis, so what normally would have taken 4 hours may take 45 minutes? Is that going to happen?
Well, yes. There was a lot of work on hypersonic transports and ballistic suborbital vehicles that would allow you to get anywhere in the world in 90 minutes to 2 hours. All of the legwork has been done, and a great deal of hardware has been tested, and it's a known quantity. We know in the same way that we could, in the past, deliver, let's say, a defensive missile system or a ballistic missile, we could easily set up a craft that would carry passengers in the same way for completely peaceful purposes. So, yes, you can expect that once approval is reached and enough passengers who can afford it are available, we will probably see transatmospheric or ballistic flights that can get you anywhere in an hour or two.
And it's all about time, Charles, isn't it? It's all about saving time.
You know, that's the one thing we have in our lives, and we don't know how much of it we have, and it's a real shame to waste it, time.
You know, it's funny because you look at the development of cell phones, and I remember owning one of those big Motorolas that looked like those military phones, and they've gotten smaller and smaller and smaller. So where with computers, it's speed and memory. With cell phones, it's the size of this thing and its capability and the things that it can do. With the space flight and with the airfare, like you're right, it is. It's whittling away time so that, your day isn't spent on a plane. It's all a convenience. How far away are we talking about for those things to be a reality?
Well, we know that already there is space tourism, and right now, if somebody were to come up with a $35 million, they could easily become a space-walking space tourist. The lunar flight could actually be pulled off pretty quickly in a matter of months or so. I would say no more than 2 years if somebody came up with $100 million. We're going to see probably transatmospheric, day-to-day transports probably within the next 10 years.
What would prohibit some private company from going to the moon, let's say, and claiming that they own part of it? I know there's been some enactment between governments.
Right.
But, I mean, technically, don't you think it might hold up in court, finders keepers? And, they basically said, look, we flew to the moon. We own this parcel of land now.
Well, actually, there are some rules and regulations that prevent that from happening. If you go online, there's something called the Archimedes Registry, where people can stake claims on celestial bodies, just as prospectors and miners did in the Old West. And in the registry, you'll find that there are different types of claims that you can stake. The weakest claim is simply to point out a plot of land on some body and say, I want that. A stronger claim would be to land a vehicle on it. And the strongest claim, of course, would be to go there in person and stick some flags in the ground and say, I'm taking this territory. To a degree, that could be done, and nobody's yet demonstrated that, actually. And some will argue that when NASA sent astronauts to the moon, we actually ended up owning the moon. That's not necessarily true, because governments are prohibited at this point from making a claim of that sort. Private individuals or companies, on the other hand, might be able to circumvent those rulings, because let's imagine you went to the moon or Mars and you staked out a claim somewhere, and let's say you even filed with the Archimedes Registry, I'm taking 50,000 acres of, Meridiani, let's say. Who could go there and stop you?
Exactly. It's fascinating. I think this is going to be a real legal mess one day.
Well, it will. And, understand that anytime there's a territory that's unclaimed or even a frontier of any sort, if people can afford to get there and they want to badly enough, they will manage to do it one way or another. So this is going to happen.
People are clamoring now to send artifacts and items, personal items, into space. Can anybody do it, or do you have to have contacts, connections?
Believe it or not, it's to the point where anyone can do it. And in fact, on the last show that I did, Robert Bigelow was on the guest list for the first hour, and
right.
He has launched a small test space station of his own, and he's planning on launching another system sometime in January. He offers a plan called Fly Your Stuff, and on that plan, you can send up small personal items for a very nominal fee. And in fact, there are a number of companies that are offering this sort of thing at this time. It's something that anybody can do. All you have to do is locate the companies, figure out how much you're willing to spend to fly something, and go ahead and make the arrangements. It's all very above board and easy to do, and anyone can do it.
What are people prepared to send up there? What aside from, I guess, the ashes of their dearly departed ones?
Well, yes, that was one very odd thing. People wanted to send the ashes of the deceased, people that they had known who, let's say, wanted to travel in space but never had the opportunity. Other items that end up getting sent are things like photographs, knickknacks, small personal items. And understand that these things go, and they're really very unlikely ever to return. There was even talk of crashing a capsule full of remains into the moon, with a few dozen capsules and ashes, and it would be like a permanent haven for that material, those ashes of the deceased. But the other things that people tend to send are just small personal or vanity items, such as photographs or, you know, small items of their own, and they can say, yes, I sent something into space. So it's right now it's sort of trivial. On the other end of the spectrum, there are serious university research programs and small business programs where they want to do research in space, and they would like to be able to fly a small satellite that can do their research or produce novel materials in microgravity. And so these are the largest up-and-coming group of customers in terms of serious payload.
Are we going to have a problem in space, Charles, in terms of too many objects up there?
Well, that's a definite possibility, and so there has to be a fairly strict control on how long something can remain in low orbit or what area of space it can be sent to. There really isn't much of a damage the danger of collision, because space is actually very, very large. But the longer something remains in orbit, then the more significant the probability of being struck by something is. I think that really we're going to have some sort of regulations enacted that prevent people from placing, you know, trivial things or large quantities of dangerous things in orbit, and that's probably going to happen pretty quickly. There are a number of regulations in place right now that sort of restrict what you can send up.
How will we know as a government, as people, that some other company, you know, you look back at the James Bond movies and the evil Spectra, and what they would do. How do we know that that's not going to happen?
Well, there's an interesting point to this, and that is everything you do right now is pretty much observed. If you launch something, the launch signatures are being observed by satellites in orbit around the Earth now. Consider how we know whether a country has launched missiles at us or not. So there are systems observing the planet right now, and many countries have them, and they look for launch signatures. So if you throw something into space, it's going to leave a signature that's going to be seen, and they're going to know pretty fast that a rocket launch has occurred. On the other hand, if you did get something into space of a significant size, you also have radar tracking, and people are watching things in space right now. They track tens of thousands of items that are orbiting the Earth, and many of them are very small. You'll recall on a shuttle flight just a while back, they lost a couple of tools in orbit. And, you know, hardware and tools can pose a real threat. Now, fortunately, in low Earth orbit, eventually those items will decay in their orbit due to the very, very thin atmospheric drag that occurs, and they will eventually end up re-entering and burning up. So, you know, that is working in our favor. But if you've got something really large up there, they now have a type of materials, metamaterials, that can actually allow you to shield things from radar. So it would make it very difficult if you were really dedicated to the task to detect something that had been properly shielded. There are development programs right now that produce materials that are in the experimental stage that actually make radar more or less flow around an object so it can't be seen.
As we had a story a couple of weeks ago, Sir Charles, where the Chinese apparently had tested some kind of laser beam that they could use on satellites, and they would be able to pinpoint and direct a laser beam either to knock it out or do something with it. That's dangerous because our entire society now is based on satellite technology.
Well, yes, it is. And a lot of people are looking at alternatives to that. One of the things that has been suggested is if we use a massive fiber optic network on the ground, to a great degree, we could decrease our dependence on satellite communications. And this is already happening in a lot of ways through the growth of the Internet itself. So consider that even though our technology has just exploded in the last four decades, a lot of the radio noise that we would have expected to create normally is not there because we're using cable and fiber optic networks to send that data instead. So, you know, it may be very well that in a few years we really won't depend on satellites so much for communication other than keeping track of objects and watching the weather.
Amazing. Well, stay with us. We're going to talk a little bit about some of these Mars images that you've sent us. And, of course, a number of other things as a direct relate to space and space flight. I'm George Norrie with our guest tonight, Sir Charles Schulz III on Coast to Coast AM. With our special guest tonight, Sir Charles Schulz III, we'll be back with him in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. China's next Shenzhou spacecraft to launch astronauts into orbit is under construction, and officials are drawing up plans for the 2008 space shot. The country's state-run media is reporting that. The country's next crewed space flight, which will be Shenzhou 7, is slated to launch three astronauts, taikonauts, spaceward, and include at least one spacewalk as China moves forward with plans to build an orbital space station. Sir Charles, is there a risk, a danger here that China will match us or even surpass us with space technology?
Oh, it's quite possible. In fact, they're making a lot of advances right now, and they're gaining a lot of technical advantages that way. Because of the things required to make spaceflight a reality, and a safe one at that, and the ability to make a profit at it also depends on your ability to do it cheaply and safely. Because of these advances, they're going to pass a lot of the things that we've done in the past soon, and they're going to possibly match us in the very near future if they proceed as the way they are.
Is it because they're doing it so well, or are we lagging for moving ahead?
Well, you know, as far as it goes, we're lagging behind. We've lost a lot of the impetus, and only the real development is occurring in private industry not in government. And it really is a fact that NASA has been more of a detriment to the development of private space flight, because who wants to compete with an organization that can, you know, come forward with billions of dollars on demand for a project? It's put a lot of small companies out of business, particularly those who had to wait for launches on NASA-run vehicles. So with the private space developments we're seeing today in our country, we're going to see a great deal of that turnaround shortly. And it's an unfortunate thing that we have to depend on, let's say, Russia to launch most of our hardware in the private sector right now. And pretty soon, some of that business could be going to China because of the developments they're making.
If you were given complete authority to set up either a governmental space program or a program that would fund the private sector, what would you do and how would you do it?
I think I would depend more on private sector growth, because you get far more ideas, and many of them are a little out of the box. Government thinking is sometimes rather restricted, even though you can get some really great talent, because you have a lot of funding, you have deep pockets to work with. But, you know, the people who have the highest confidence in what they're doing and in their abilities, and the ones who have the biggest challenges in front of them, tend to produce very much, you know, everything that we have. If it were up to me, I would set up some sort of an office in the government to work with private companies to develop different aspects of the commercial space flight industry. I certainly wouldn't restrict it the way NASA and the government have at the present time.
Let's talk again about who some of the major players are in private space development. Of course, you mentioned Bigelow. We've got Virgin. He's doing very well building what he's doing. He's even building his spaceport. What other companies are involved here, Sir Charles?
Well, okay, you know, you mentioned Robert Bigelow, and he's one of the biggest players with his company, Bigelow Aerospace. Burt Rutan from Scaled Composites is one of the major figures in space development, and you can find him at scaled.com, and he has a long history of aeronautical innovations and has been one of the truly most significant contributors to aviation in years. As everyone probably knows, he and his efforts won the X Prize a couple of years ago, and he's produced a vehicle that can carry passengers for suborbital flights. And then he sold that technology to Sir Richard Branson, who's our next major figure in private space development. Now, Sir Richard is developing spacecraft from that technology, and he has Virgin Galactic, and that is a company that will offer $200,000 suborbital space flights to anybody who comes up with the money. And they will be flying, I believe, in less than 2 years, the way things are running. And he's basically mass-producing these vehicles. And, you know, let me point out that it would take just a very minor modification, and instead of carrying passengers, you could actually launch a small satellite from one of these things with a booster on it to place it in orbit. So that's just something for people to consider that might not have come to the table yet. Another player is Elon Musk, and SpaceX is his company. Now, this is interesting because Elon Musk started in electronic publishing, and he set up a company that became PayPal.
Okay.
And made many millions of dollars on the internet. And one of his projects was the Mars Oasis project. He planned to land a greenhouse on Mars and use the soil to grow crops. And it came to a halt because of the exorbitant cost of launch. So he began to dedicate himself and his company that he started to bringing the cost of launch down, so it'd be far more reasonable so that he and other companies as well could be able to afford this sort of thing. And here's another interesting one. John Carmack of Armadillo Aerospace. Now, many people don't know, John Carmack is the fellow who wrote the game Doom, and everybody has played Doom. It's a very popular computer and video game, and there is even a movie made at one point. Well, John Carmack was the guy who wrote the game, and he made millions of dollars on it and founded Armadillo Aerospace, and they've made a very serious effort and built some very interesting flight hardware. Now, his company recently competed in the Lunar Lander Challenge that was held and was just a hair's breadth away from actually winning. Basically, they had to launch a vehicle that under robotic control or automatic control would fly to a designated area, make a landing, pick up and come back again, and land at the original takeoff site. And it's a very interesting challenge, and it's a very technically difficult challenge, and they're very close to cracking it. And another person, Peter Diamandis, who is in the XPRIZE Foundation, he's the head of the XPRIZE Foundation, and he's also the co-founder of Zero Gravity Corporation. And that's a company that gives zero gravity flights aboard aircraft that fly the parabolic paths. It simulates zero G for the passengers. And he also created the Rocket Racing League, which we'll be seeing a lot of things in the news with very shortly. And he's the co-founder and director of Space Adventures Limited, and that's the company that's flown for Space Tourists, the International Space Station. So they're making money, and they're doing business. John Powell from JP Aerospace, that's another competitor. He's working on a concept of airships to orbit. Basically, they're flying high-altitude balloon craft that take packages to the very edge of space. Then they're developing an airship to orbit craft, so they'll be able to launch them into space from the top edge of the atmosphere, using literally a balloon to get you up there. Then there's Jeff Bezos from Blue Origin. Now, he's the founder of Amazon.com. And many people know that's where he made his billions. And so we see a lot of people who are entrepreneurs or mavericks, who some of them are internet billionaires, and they're putting their money into space. And people may wonder why. Well, it's the up-and-coming thing. We know that there's going to be life in space. People are going to be moving and working and commuting there.
Sure.
And so these people are investing because they see where the future is. Now, his company is developing a reusable liquid fuel propulsion system, and they're working toward a manned suborbital launch system that'll give you low-cost launch services. And then another one, David Mastin of Mastin Space Systems. They're putting together standard launch systems for payloads in 1-kilogram increments. So if you wanted to launch 2 or 5 or 7 kilograms, you could work out a very easy pay schedule and figure out what it's going to cost, and they'll launch it for you. And they're selling slots in their vehicles for something called CANSATs. You basically can put something up about the size of a soda can that weighs 350 grams, and they're working on basically flying anything you want, and they're working on larger packages as well, as long as it's, you know, not hazardous and not going to blow up their rocket. And then there are non-rocketry solutions to space travel. Michael Lane at Liftport, that's a space elevator company, they're developing the space elevator hardware that will go up and down a tether made of carbon fibers, and this tether will reach from orbit all the way to the ground. And then there's Bradley C. Edwards of Carbon Designs Incorporated. They have a high lift systems thing. They're at AmericanAntiGravity.com. They have a page there that you can see what they're doing. And basically, these are people who are building elevators that go all the way into space from the ground.
That concept is incredible, isn't it?
Well, yes, it is. And it can be a very serious competitor to spaceflight because it's so low in cost. And once it's set up, it could actually compete very favorably with a lot of transport systems, because you can carry something halfway up the tether and let it go, and it will ballistically proceed to the ground somewhere with a little guidance. You can develop stuff that will go all over the world without the use of rockets. You go up in an elevator to some altitude, you kick the payload out, and it follows a path to the ground. Now, they could both run into some trouble in the near term because of the materials they're using. Composites are the issue here. You know, Boeing and other large aircraft companies are presently developing air bodies that will be completely made of composites rather than a magnesium or aluminum. And they want to do this because it's going to cut thousands of pounds off every aircraft they produce. Well, if they go ahead with the plan, then it's going to put a serious dent into the availability of carbon and composite materials over the next few years. Presently, aircraft and sporting goods are the largest use of carbon composites, as far as I've been able to determine. You know, golf clubs and bicycles and kayaks, all these things are made out of carbon composites now.
Exactly. Airplane brakes, right?
Exactly. And if Boeing or other large companies decides to use this material on the scale that they're planning, it would actually make this material unavailable to many other industries. So I would suggest if they do go ahead with their plan, you might want to invest in that as a growth industry, because carbon composites are going to be a very important material. And so there could be an effect on the materials needed to build a space elevator as well as other things.
You know, it's funny, Sir Charles, a dear friend of mine owns a carbon fiber company. He's one of the major stockholders now, but he formed the company, started it. It's now publicly held. I'm not going to give the name of the company because everybody will run on the stock. But he is building plants in Hungary. He's got a few there, but he's expanding. He's got plants here in the United States. And he claims that the demand for carbon fiber is going to be absolutely outrageous in the future, just like you say.
Well, it is. And people have to consider, you know, how industries and space travel are very tightly related. You know, many years ago, whenever there'd be a slowdown in the defense industry, people would think, well, it'll just shut down this defense plant. But really, it doesn't, because the materials that a defense company or an aerospace company happens to use are things like microchips and refined metals and specialty items, and those have to be produced by other companies. And so each of those companies has to have a staff of people to produce those materials, and they have to have the resources on hand to produce it. And there's a whole pyramid of industry that's behind the production of, let's say, a single missile or a single flight vehicle. So when you have a slowdown or an increase in the industry, it really has a huge effect on industry of our country as a whole. So growth in the space industries actually will have a very beneficial effect, even on things we wouldn't perceive as being directly related to it.
Explain the elevator concept, because I assume it'll be anchored, of course, to the planet. That'll be the base where the elevator starts, and up the cables it goes. What the heck is it anchored to in space? How does it stay up there?
Well, actually, it's very simple. You can imagine a satellite that's in stationary orbit high above the Earth. If you were to go up 22,300 miles above the equator and place a satellite in orbit, it would move at precisely the same rate that the Earth rotates. So it effectively would be stationary in the sky for us.
Right.
Now, suppose you made a cable from that satellite and you began extending it to the ground. As long as you extend the cable down to the ground and in the opposite direction you have a countermass that balances it, the satellite will still remain in its same place in orbit. Well, eventually, the one end of the cable could reach the ground. So the satellite, most of the mass, remains in orbit. That's what keeps it up.
Theoretically, if you tugged on the cable, could you begin to pull that satellite down?
Well, in theory, but you see, by putting a countermass at the far end, when you attach it to the ground, it's under tension.
Okay.
And so now you don't have to worry about it.
So the countermass...
That's right. It will counteract the force of weight hanging on the cable.
And how long would it take to travel up this elevator?
If you were going up at elevator speeds, a couple of hundred miles per hour or so, or a couple hundred kilometers per hour, then you would expect to get up to the geostationary point in about 8 to 10 days. It really depends on how fast the system can travel up the cable safely.
Would that be a vehicle for travel for people? I mean, would groups of 10 or 20, I don't know how big the elevator would be, go up that way?
It could, but right now what we would be looking at is hauling cargo up to build more space elevators. And most of the time you would be using them simply for hauling materials up rather than down, because anything can come back down pretty easily using a standard reentry system. So, yes, in effect, you could have a system that actually could carry people up to geostationary orbit as passengers on, let's say, a 10-day cruise. And once they got there, they would have access to anything in space, because once you're there, you're halfway to anywhere in the universe.
Well, can you imagine if they built hotels and then they have these elevators attached to them? That brings back a whole new meaning to everything that hotels in this on the planet Earth have been doing.
Well, yes, it does. And, you know, one of the strategies, incidentally, to anchoring the cable, the other end of the space elevator, to the ground, is actually to have a floating platform at sea. And this would mean you wouldn't infringe on anybody's territory, or you wouldn't depend on having to find land right on the equator. There's
right,
not a whole lot
point.
Of land on the Earth that is on the equator that we'd have easy access to. So an ocean-going platform would be the probably the best solution to that.
Well, and as big as this planet is, there is that possibility that a plane might clip into the cable, isn't there?
Well, the possibility is there, but you'd have to have a no-fly zone instituted, as we do for many things
Absolutely.
On the ground already. So that wouldn't really be much of a difficulty.
How many elevators one day, let's look 100 years into the future, assuming this is a great way to get up there, how many elevators might we have on this planet?
Well, there could be dozens or hundreds eventually if it turns out that that's the cheapest way to go. Understand that economics is generally the thing that will drive this, and of course the laws of physics. But, you know, in 100 years, we may have something radically different. We may figure out how to manipulate gravity at that point, you know, and I wouldn't put it past people. And at that point, it probably wouldn't make a lot of sense to have a space elevator. But until that day, or until that capability is available, the space elevator is a very sensible way to go if we can make it work. And there are still some unresolved questions, but I do believe, you know, I feel very optimistic about it.
Some of the players that you mentioned in private space travel, some of them are characters. I mean, Richard Branson is a character. I remember watching him when Stephen Fawcett in Branson's plane went around the world nonstop. I mean, he loves life. He's excitable. I like the guy. He kind of reminds me of a Donald Trump, almost like a take-charge person. Who is the spearhead right now for private space? Is it Branson, Bigelow? Who's out there? Who's really number one?
Well, definitely both of them are right at the top of the list. And you have to consider for a moment that this isn't something that a timid individual does. When you're investing hundreds of millions or billions of dollars of your own money in a venture, you have to know at the outset that the person who's willing to do that has to be a firecracker. You know, you're not an individual that's going to sit at home on the couch.
There's no return right now.
Well, yes, and it only stands to reason, because if you have the drive and initiative to get out there and make $1 billion, you're not the type of person who sits at home anyway. You're going to go and look for the most exciting things to do and the most interesting things to do. And simultaneously, you're going to temper that with common sense, because you're not going to simply throw your money away.
And I think part of their mission isn't necessarily to make more money, because they've already done that. I think it's the challenge to do something interesting and fascinating.
Well, absolutely. You know, each of us has an opportunity to contribute something to the world we live in. And if we can just make it a little nicer or a better place just because we've lived here, then that's a wonderful thing. And people who are particularly very wealthy have great opportunities to help improve how we live and how the world is. And so when they actually go forth and do that, it's a very inspiring thing.
Well, it sure is. Next hour, Charles, let's talk about Mars and some of those anomalies there with some of the images that you have sent us. As we talk about, again, the privatization of space, I agree with you. I think it's the way to go. We should have done it 20 years ago.
Well, yes, absolutely, we should have.
But we did not. We did not. How about other countries that have been in space? You know, the Europeans, they have their union. Are they looking toward privatization? I mean, Branson is from the United Kingdom, but are there other countries that are going private, or are they still governmental?
Well, a lot of it is governmental, and, you know, the regulations there are quite different. But there are companies that are operating offshore from the United States and in other countries, and they've gotten actually some very favorable tax breaks and conditions on, you know, for their work. There are companies that have actually set up spaceports and research centers outside our country because the regulations are less stringent. It really depends on where you go and who you're associated with. Right now, the regulations in our country are very restrictive in many ways, although there have been some very positive changes made in the last few years.
Stick with us with our special guest, Sir Charles Schulz III. Henry, by the way, from Hawaii, writes, simply fast-blast me and said, George, we're going to need some really good elevator music if we're going to send people all the way to the top floor of a space hotel. So true, Henry, so true. Back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.